Good morning. And I also want to say happy Father's Day to everyone, whether you are a father, will someday be a father, or even have a father. Father's Day is a great day to show appreciation to the fathers or those in our lives who have played a father-ish role. Is that a word? There may be a lot of words that I make up here today. But, you know, somebody made up all the words, right? So why not me? I tried to show appreciation to my father when I was in high school, especially. I decided I'd take him to a movie. We'd have a father-daughter day. My father was an extreme introvert. He made me look like a roaring extrovert, and if you know me well enough, that kind of gives you an idea. My father probably literally spoke to three people in his life. So he was also extremely conservative, which I should have remembered before I took him to see The Graduate. And I did remember it. It was a little late. It was about the time that Elaine and Ben were on their first date. And, well, if you saw the movie, you remember the tassels. And I will remember them to my dying day. So when that happened, my father began to steam. And you could literally see the steam coming off the top of his head. And that was the longest movie I have ever been to. I thought it would never end. The end when Ben's yelling, Elaine, I'm thinking, thank God. But my father and I made a silent agreement to never speak of it again, and we never did until this day. But despite that faux pas, I like movies, and there's going to be a few movie references in this sermon. But to honor my father this Father's Day, The Graduate will not be one of them. So way back in the late 1960s, I saw another movie that impacted me greatly. As a matter of fact, it propelled me from bubblegummy, puppy love, teeny bopper crushes to my first legitimate adult celebrity crush. And I say that, I wonder how many pastors actually start their sermon that way. But I told someone this morning I was a mediocre pastor, so there you have it. Because before you today, I stand and admit that I had a long, enduring crush on Robert Redford. I see I'm not alone. It all happened the instant that I went to a drive-in theater on Foothill Boulevard, Altadena, California, and the Sundance Kid sat across a poker table. Having been accused of cheating by someone who likely also was cheating, the accuser backed down, but then stupidly said, "Hey, kid, how fast are you?" And with steely blue-eyed glare, Sundance shot the terrified man's gun out of his holster and with two more well-aimed shots, shot the gun into the corner where it lay spinning on the floor. And thus, a crush was born. But that also has nothing to do with this morning's message. But there is a scene later on in the movie after Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid have robbed one too many trains one too many times, where they're pursued over miles and miles and miles by a law enforcement team that included professional trackers. And time after time, Butch and Sundance think they've lost them and are in the clear, only to find that these almost superhuman pursuers are still hot on their heels. At one point, and this is where I have cleverly woven this into my sermon, Butch says to Sundance, "Who are those guys?" And that is the inspiration for this sermon title. Who is this guy? Who is this guy? Because this week's passage, Jesus kicks academia right out of his parables, and the rubber meets the road. The disciples in the crowd see Jesus demonstrate his authority and power face to face, and it shakes them to the core. Now, last week, Brian led us through a passage that consists of Jesus' actual teachings to the crowds, and then in more depth to the disciples. As Brian told you, one of Jesus' preferred teaching methods is the use of parables, which are graphic images and stories from everyday life, through which Jesus invites his audience into an insider experience of the kingdom of God. And our passage today, which is Mark 4:35 through 5:20, comes on the heels of Jesus' ministry to the crowd. Now, recall, if you will, the chaos depicted in this picture, Christ's entry into Brussels. Now, this painting is set 1,800 years later, approximately, than our story, But I think the similarity of the jostling of the crowds, the smelly, unkempt, generally clueless crowd in the picture has very many similarities with what Jesus and his disciples may have been surrounded by. Now, a theme to look at in today's verses contrasts chaos with peace. And as I read them, I was drawn back to a verse in Deuteronomy 30, 19 and 20. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today. I have set before you life or death, blessing or curse. Oh, that you would choose life, that you and your children might live. Choose to love the Lord your God, to obey him, to cling to him, for he is your life and the length of your days. You will then be able to live safely in the land the Lord promised your ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, as we read our passage for today, I want you to be on the lookout, as I said, for contrast between chaos and peace, bondage and freedom. Hear the longing that God expresses when he says, oh, that you would choose life. That's his desire. And each of these real-life illustrations contain an invitation to the disciples and to others who witness them, and to you and to me. Choose now who you will serve. Remember again, Jesus has just been teaching the crowds in parables and then draws the disciples aside to give them a deeper understanding of what he has just taught. And the phrase he repeated over and over is probably still ringing in their ears. He who has ears, let him hear. And as Brian said last week, the verb tense in the Hebrew culture takes hear further than just hearing. It contains an invitation, even a command, to hear, but not only hear, to listen, attend, internalize, and finally, let those words change who you are, what you do, and how and why you do it. Think of the song we sang this morning. We sing, holy, holy to the King of Kings. We sing, but let that verb internalize into you and make a difference in who you are. That's just a subtle plug for pursuing spiritual formation in case you may have missed it. Anyway, after an exhausting day of teaching, Jesus, as is habit, withdraws from the crowd. But usually when he does this, he goes off on his own, right? But this time he takes his disciples with him. One might wonder why. And it will become obvious, I think, I hope, because he has something for them to see, something for them to learn, and something that puts the hearing to a test, that puts the rubber on the road. So we're going to read Mark 4, 35 to 520, and we're going to use the voice translation today. And I kind of like this. This is one of my new favorites. I like to read out of different translations because they pick up a different flavor. And the voice translation tends to bring a lot of drama into it. And in these two particular vignettes, there's a lot of drama to be had. So here we go. Fasten your seatbelts. It's a long passage. As evening fell, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let's cross to the other side of the lake." So they took him just as he was and started out, leaving the crowds behind, though other boats followed. But soon a terrible storm arose. High waves began to break into the boat until it was nearly full of water and about to sink. Jesus was asleep at the back of the boat with his head on a cushion. Frantically, they waked him, shouting, "Teacher, don't you even care that we're about ready to drown?" Then he rebuked the wind and the sea. "Quiet down," he said. And the wind fell, and there was great calm. Then he asked them, "Why were you so fearful? Don't you even yet have confidence in me?" And they were filled with awe and said among themselves, "Who is this man that even the wind and the seas obey him?" When they arrived to the other side of the lake, a demon-possessed man ran out from the graveyard just as Jesus was climbing from the boat. This man lived among the gravestones and had such strength that whenever he was put into handcuffs and shackles, as he often was, He snapped the handcuffs from his wrists and smashed the shackles and walked away. No one was strong enough to control him. All day long and throughout the night, he would wander among the tombs and in the wild hills, screaming and cutting himself with sharp pieces of stone. When Jesus was still far out on the water, when Jesus was still far away, what does that put you in mind of? The prodigal son. Anyway, when Jesus was far out on the water, the man had seen him and run to him and fell down before him. And Jesus spoke to the demon within the man and said, "Come out, evil spirit." It gave a terrible scream, shrieking, "What are you going to do to me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? For God's sake, don't torture me." "What's your name?" Jesus asked. And the demon replied, "Legion, for there are many of us within this man." Then the demons begged him again and again not to send them to some distant land. Now, as it happened, there was a huge herd of hogs rooting around the hill above the lake. "Send us into those hogs," the demon begged. And Jesus gave him permission. Then the evil spirits came out of the man and entered the hogs, and the entire herd plunged down the steep hillside into the lake and drowned. The herdsmen fled to a town nearby, in the nearby countryside, spreading the news as they ran. Everyone rushed out to see for themselves, and a large crowd soon gathered where Jesus was. But as they saw the man sitting there, fully clothed and perfectly sane, they were frightened. Those who saw what happened were telling everyone about it, and the crowd began pleading with Jesus to go away and leave them alone. So he got back in the boat. The man who had been possessed by the demons begged Jesus to let him go along, but Jesus said no. "Go home to your friends," he told them. "Tell them what wonderful things God has done for you and how merciful he has been." So the man started off to visit the 10 towns of that region and began to tell everyone about the great things Jesus had done for him. And they were awestruck by his story. Phew, that's a lot, isn't it? It's a lot to listen to, but even more, a lot to live through. So I can imagine the disciples, let alone the crowds, looking at one another in a combination of fear and amazement, going, "Who is this guy?" Let's tear the passage apart a bit and see what we can glean from it. With the advantage of 20/20 hindsight and the help of brilliant theologians who have written volumes about this, and again, I want to thank James R. Edwards and his commentary, The Gospel According to Mark. I think it was Howard Thurman, who said something along the lines of the importance of figuring out who it is who knows what you need to know and then to kind of get to know those guys. And that's kind of what we've done as a teaching team with the Gospel of Mark. Edwards has a lot to say about the book of Mark, and we have been gleaning from it tremendously. So the highlights of these two passages are Jesus's miracles. And while we cannot and must not discount those, we must also not get distracted by them. Jesus is not doing a 4th of July fireworks show here. There's a reason he calmed the storm and a reason he healed the demoniac. And that reason is important. So as I continue this morning, keep an ear tuned for that. Jesus' calming the storm in the Sea of Galilee is recorded in 3 of the 4 Gospels, here in Mark, also in Matthew 8 and Luke 8. Mark's version fleshes the story out a bit more and includes the hour of the day, the other boats that were present, that the boat took on water, and that Jesus was asleep on a cushion, and even the disciples' sarcasm in Jesus' rebuke. It also took a stronger word describing the disciples' fear. It's translated as terrified, but the original word invokes an absolute gut-tearing horror brought on by the reality of impending death by drowning, which is probably every sailor's worst nightmare. So let's talk about the boat. Brian mentioned it last week. It was little. Really little, and not something you'd want to be in a squall. In 1986, the hull of a fishing boat was recovered off the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee, and carbon dating places it between 120 BC and 40 AD. It's probably very similar to the boat that Jesus and the disciples were in on that day. about 27 feet long, 7 feet wide, 4 to 5 feet high. The fore and aft sections appear to have been covered with a deck, providing space on which to sit or to lie down. And it had a total capacity of about 15 people. So in a boat very similar to this, 12 disciples and Jesus set off across the Sea of Galilee in pursuit, or so they thought, of some peace and quiet. But on their way to peace and quiet, a furious squall brought on by the Galileans' tempestuous weather conditions caused something like a hurricane. And where do we find Jesus in the midst of the storm? You know, in the back of the boat, on the cushions, asleep. And if you're into Bible trivia, it's interesting to note this is the only place recorded in the Gospels where Jesus actually slept, of all the times. Now, a couple weeks ago, we did a contemplative exercise imagining ourselves on the boat in the hurricane in a state of mortal terror. In confronting Jesus, and as one of your pastors, I also challenged myself to dig underneath all the things I should have wanted to say to Jesus in that moment. But my honest, unedited, unvarnished, no halo on me words to Jesus were, "Dude, what the hell?" And yes, it's recorded forever in my journal, and now on video. Send your complaints to Dan Cameron at dan@liminalbonfire.com. Hi, Dan. Well, Matthew was not as honest as I am. He softened his wording a bit into a prayer. "Lord, save us. We're sinking." And Luke makes it more of a plea for help. "Master, Master. We're sinking." Captain Obvious. But Mark's words reflect frustration and desperation, and I think one would say, if transported into a similar situation, "Teacher, don't you even care if we drown?" Now, here's something to note. Jesus' reaction to his disciples' reproach reflects his divine humility. It's the same humility that we'll show later when their verbal reproach becomes outright abandonment. Jesus can take and can accept our honesty, our reproaches, our frustrations. He does not become defensive, offensive, or irritated with us. He listens. He loves us still. And in fact, and this is pure Jenny here, I think he might actually prefer that to the well-curated image that we prefer to show him. I think he likes it when we're real and honest and when the halo comes off. Keep that in mind when you pray. Well, back to the story. Jesus does not abandon them to a watery grave. They don't drown, and in fact, he rebuked the wind and the waves and told them to be quiet and sit still. That would be the wind and the waves, not the disciples. Be at peace, calm down, rest. Have you ever wondered what Jesus' tone was? I mean, sometimes you think of it sort of like, Charlton Heston, you know. I think he just said, shh. He didn't need to yell. Anyway, whatever, the words packed a punch. But let's look at the Greek word that is used in verse 39. The word translated as rebuked is epitamen, and that word is used twice before in Mark in terms of rebuking evil spirits. In other words, it is a word properly used in an exorcism. And the word used for be still is pephioso, which means to muzzle. It is as though Jesus saw the storm as something demonic, something meant to hinder his mission. And as he would to any other demon, he rebuked it, told it to knock it off, and shut up. Or in more churchy words, peace, be still. The Bible often uses wind and waves to symbolize hostile forces over which God prevails. Think of Jonah. Think of the Egyptians drowning in the Red Sea. Oh, and then there was the flood, which God used to wipe out evil that had infected the world. So the symbolism of this story goes beyond Jesus' power over nature, but rather depicts Jesus as the strong man from Mark 3:27, who vanquishes Satan and plunders evil minions. But the main point here is not that Jesus has power over nature, but rather that Jesus can and does do the things that only God can do. Let's look back at Psalm 107, 23 to 32. This is talking about God. Some went out on the sea in ships. There were merchants on the mighty waters, and they saw the works of the Lord, his wonderful deeds in the deep. For he spoke and stirred up a tempest that lifted high the waves. They mounted up to the heavens and went down to the depths. In their peril, their courage melted away. They reeled and staggered like drunkards. They were at their wits' end, and they cried out to the Lord in their trouble. And he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper, and the waves of the sea were hushed. They were glad when it grew calm, and God desired them to their desired haven. He guided them to their desired haven. Well, I was talking with Brian White a couple weeks ago, and he brought up a question that I want to pose to you this morning. What do you think was more terrifying to the disciples? The storm or the one who stilled it with a word? Think about that. Who is this guy? When we immerse ourselves in being our Lord's beloved, I think it's really important to whatever ability we have, just who it is who loves us. Who is this man? The Israelites, for all their wanderings, got it right in Exodus. When God parted the Red Sea, here's what's recorded. And when the Israelites saw the great power of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him. It's the and put their trust in him. That, my friends, is the point. Know God in God's fullness and then act accordingly. Put your trust in God. Don't get distracted by the fireworks. Well, the storm is calm. The boat lands safely. The power of Jesus has prevailed over chaos and destruction and brings peace and calm to the waters. All is well for the moment. Because now we find Jesus and the disciples in the region of the Gerasenes. Now, there's a bit of controversy here because the city of Gerasa is not on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, but about 35 miles inland. So it's about a 2 days journey to the shore. And in order to quell the controversy, let's think of Los Angeles. When I was in England and I was asked, where are you from? I said, Los Angeles. Why? Because no one in England has ever heard of Thousand Oaks. Los Angeles is a recognizable area. But let's think of Los Angeles. It can mean the city or it can mean the county. And if I say I live in the region of Los Angeles, I'm probably referring to the county, right? So if I live in the region of Los Angeles, I could live in Palmdale or Pomona or Palos Verdes. Right? So while this may not seem important, it just may be, especially if you happen to be a pig. But I'm getting ahead of myself. There is something more important about the region of the Gerasenes. It's one of the 10 cities of the Decapolis. And Bartle Pixner, a noted scholar on Galilee, helps clarify the Jewish view of the pagan Decapolis, saying that in the Talmud, and in the writings of the church fathers, people of this area were described as belonging to the 7 Canaanite nations that were driven out of the promised land by Joshua and the Israelites. The reason being that these nations worshiped Baal, they engaged in various perversions, child sacrifice and worship, and ate and sacrificed pigs, which are considered to be unclean. In other words, it was considered a pagan area, not a Jewish area. It was a place not to go if you were Jewish, and especially if you were the Messiah. But even so, Jesus' ability to heal preceded him. And when he landed ashore, or shortly thereafter, he's presented with a man who is demon-possessed. Now, the description of this man is sort of graphic. He lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he'd often been chained hand and foot. But he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. Mark's description seems to describe a ferocious animal. rather than a human being. And in fact, the word in Greek used for subdue is damazo, I don't know. I don't speak Greek if you didn't know, which was the word used for taming a wild beast in James 3:7. Now, we've talked a lot about the Mark and sandwich, and I was afraid I wasn't going to have one, but it turns out I do. This week, the bread of our sandwich consists of two storms. We have the storm on the outside on the Sea of Galilee and the storm on the inside within the demon-possessed man. And the filling, if you will, consists of Jesus' authority to bring peace out of chaos. So while I was tempted to construct a deviled ham sandwich for you, I think the best I can do is a Reuben on marble dry. The marble dry represents the swirling of the storm, both the physical storm and the internal storm of the demoniac. And the melted cheese inside represents the calming of the sauerkraut of the disciples' anger at Jesus, the storm, and the unclean spirit represented by the shredded ham. A Mark and marble rye Reuben. I was pretty happy with that. But back to our story. The healing of the Gerasene demoniac is the third exorcism that's recorded in Mark. And this poor man is beyond hope. Not only can he not control himself, he's not able to be controlled by anyone else, even when bound in chains and irons. And in all honesty, he should have been someone that Jesus would have shunned because he was unclean, an unclean man from an unclean location in an unclean geographical area. He was veritably the trifecta of filth. Let's look at the elements of uncleanliness. First, we have the setting. Decapolis, which is Gentile and even worse, a pagan area, declared unclean since the time of Joshua. Then we have the demoniac himself, who lives in tombs. Now, the book of Numbers states that anyone who is exposed to the dead is considered defiled until purified. And if he does not purify himself, he's cut off from Israel. Rabbinic tradition expands contact with the dead to mean anyone who has contact with anything associated with the dead, including their dwelling place, their mattress, their pillow, or the tomb. So Jesus sees the demoniac, and the demoniac hurls himself at Jesus and the disciples, but mid-hurl, the demons recognize who Jesus is, and the man falls to his knees before Jesus. As Edwards says in his commentary, when demoniac meets divine, it's a no contest event. It seems that the demon recognized that as well as he begs, "Swear to God that you will not torture me." Literally in Greek, it says, "I adjure you, Son of the Most High God," leaving no doubt at least the demons knew who Jesus was and the extent of his power and authority. So Jesus engages the demon in dialogue, and the demon admits that his name is Legion, that there are many residing within this poor demon-possessed man. Instead of being tortured by Jesus, they beg Jesus to let them go into a herd of swine, numbering about 2,000, and Jesus does so. The swine, in turn, run toward a cliff and leap into the waters below. Well, let's talk a minute about these pigs. The Mishnah states, none may rear swine anywhere. Well, in the region of Gerasene, they raised pigs, lots of pigs, pigs everywhere the eyes could see. And these pigs were likely being reared to supply the Roman legions with pork, which made it doubly offensive. Before looking into this passage, I'd always wondered why there were pigs there anyway, not realizing that this region was not Jewish, but rather Gentile. And therefore, raising pigs was a legitimate and profitable enterprise for them, especially if there were hungry Roman legions to feed, which makes the end of the story make more sense. Normally, when Jesus did a miracle, people wanted him to stick around, right? No, I said people, not religious leaders. But in this case, the people asked him to leave right after the unfortunate drowning of the pig incident. Why? Well, for starters, I would imagine seeing their expected yield of pork bellies jump off into a cliff along with all the profits would have resulted in the sale and expectations of the Roman legions of purchasing enough to feed them over a considerable period of time, would have caused a problem. This would have been a catastrophic economic loss for the region, to say nothing of having to explain the lack of pigs to the hungry Romans. Can you imagine the pig farmer saying to Russell Crowe, gladiator-type person, who came to inquire why the pigs had not been delivered? "Well, you see, Your Grace, there was this demon-possessed guy, and then a Jewish teacher came, and the demon-possessed guy's fine now, thank you for asking, but the pigs all jumped in the water and drowned, so we're going to wait for next year's crop, okay?" So it's not at all surprising that the city fathers asked Jesus ever so politely, because they saw what happened to the demons and the pigs, and they were not interested in provoking his wrath, to leave the area. "Sir, please, if you don't mind." Something else to notice. Post-healing, the formerly demon-possessed man asked to follow Jesus. He was now dressed and in his right mind, reminiscent of the calm after the storm in the Sea of Galilee. Normally, Jesus would have said, "Of course," but not this time. Instead, rather than adhering to his normal pattern of asking a healed person to be quiet about it, Jesus does not swear him to silence, but rather says, "Go home to your own people and tell them what the Lord has done for you this day and how he's had mercy on you." So the man went away and spread the word to all of Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And all the people were amazed. Edward suggests that since Jesus' primary mission was to the Jews, being sidetracked in a Gentile region would have been a distraction. Some commentaries suggest that having a Gentile in his midst would have caused even more resistance among the Jewish leaders to Jesus' message. I don't know about that. I mean, they were already plotting to kill him, so, you know, what's a little more resistance? But that's what they say, so I'm just laying it out there for you. Or perhaps, since Jesus has now been effectively banished from the area, he leaves this man as an emissary to spread the good news. One way or another, essentially, this demon-possessed man becomes the first missionary sent by Jesus, and remarkably, he's sent to the Gentiles. One last question. What on earth was Jesus doing there anyway? Did he just get blown there by the storm? I doubt it. My guess is apparently he thought that very spot was where he needed to be to do the will of his Father. That tends to be the sole catalyst in terms of motivation for whatever Jesus does ever, doing the will of his Father. And Jesus was not at risk either from the storm or from the demoniac. In answer to Mark's question, "Master, don't you even care that we're going to drown?" Jesus might have answered, "Well, I care greatly, but I'm not concerned." Sometimes I think we have this idea that Jesus is in heaven, wringing his hands at the mess we've made of this world, and we have made a mess of it. But he's not. Yes, he cares. He cares deeply. But concerned? No. Who can silence the wind and the waves? Whatever mess we have created on this earth is not messy enough to derail his purposes. Further, Jesus had no need to fear becoming ceremonially unclean via contact with a demoniac, Decapolis, or the pigs, because he himself was above the effects of sin and demonic forces. So what have we learned thus far in Mark? Jesus supersedes the powers of nature, demons, illness, death, and family influence. Jesus does things that only God can do. And Jesus does only the things that are within God's perfect will. These passages show graphically that Jesus is more than the guy who says wise stuff. He's more than the guy who refuses to be bound by the powers that be. He's more than the guy who has an astounding ability to heal. As the disciples' eyes are slowly opened to reality, they see Jesus is not just the deliverer of fine sermons. He acts within and delivers the power and the authority of Yahweh, creator of all things, the Alpha, the Omega, the Almighty God. While we are still on earth, we will never have a complete answer to our question, who is this guy? And we won't until we stand face to face and all things that are to be revealed to us are revealed to us. But we do know that Jesus' presence brings with it an invitation, and I place it for you again. You have seen and you have heard. Choose now. Who will you serve? Choose now. What will you believe? Choose now. Who will you emulate? Choose now between life and death. Well, I began the sermon with a movie reference, and I will end it with one as well. We all have a choice, many choices, every day. We can choose to pursue peace over chaos, belief over unbelief, faith over despair, love over hate. Our assignment is to watch for those invitations throughout the day and to choose wisely in all things, big and small. And at the end of our final day of this life, I think we all long to hear Jesus say, "You've chosen well." So I leave you with this, and may this tongue-in-cheek reference stick with you as you and help you on your journey.